Welcome to the third podcast of the Johns Hopkins University Virtual Alumni Book Club for the 2010-2011 academic year. I am your moderator, Jay Lenro, alumnus of the class of 1973 and a vice president of the Hopkins Alumni Association. We are here on a warm spring afternoon in Mergenthaler Hall on the Homewood campus on the last day of classes for the school year. It was just days ago that thousands of alums and their families traveled to Homewood for Alumni Reunion Weekend. Later this month, several thousand students from the class of 2011 will march across the Hopkins Seal on Homewood Field to mark their passage from students to alumni. I would like to take this opportunity to welcome them as our newest members of the JHU Alumni Association. It is my pleasure today to introduce our faculty host, Dr. Carl Alexander, John Dewey Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins, who will discuss this month's selection, Outliers, The Story of Success by Malcolm Gladwell. Dr. Alexander was born in Philadelphia and graduated from Temple University and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he received his doctorate in sociology. He began teaching at Johns Hopkins in 1972. His primary research and teaching interests are in the sociology of education, social stratification, life course development, and research methodology. His research tries to understand why certain children and some kinds of children are more successful in school than others and how this affects them later in life. Dr. Alexander is mentioned prominently in Gladwell's book in the chapter entitled Merida's Bargain, where he states, quote, "Virtually all of the advantage wealthy students have over poor students is the result of differences in the way privileged kids learn while they are not in school," end quote. Please welcome Dr. Alexander.
Oh, thanks very much. It's my pleasure to be able to have this conversation with you and to share my thoughts. And let me also welcome the newest entrance into the Hopkins family of alums.
Professor, this is a book that has received a wide dichotomy of reviews and opinions. And the camps seem to be split between those who love the simplicity and find the book easy to understand and identify with, and then those who tend to criticize it because they don't think it's scholarly enough and too popularist rather than being a real scholarly work of sociology. You and I were just talking about the fact that there's truly a need for both types of work. So to start off, I would like to ask you your thoughts on that, and then I'll get into a few questions about the book.
Sure. Well, it's not a work of scholarship in the classical sense. It's not heavily annotated. There's not a rigorous methodology that leads you unambiguously to a set of conclusions. It tells stories, and it tells them in a very engaging way, and it connects the stories and the themes of those stories to issues of great importance to all of us. So I think its usefulness is in helping us see connections between things that ordinary people, without Gladwell's careful, thoughtful, well-trained eye, just miss. We don't see those connections that he's able to draw. And in drawing them, he weaves together a story that otherwise would be ponderous, and he makes it engaging. And with the wide range of topics that he touches upon throughout the book, it's really quite remarkable in its scope, and yet consistently returns to the dominant theme that he's developing. So, not scholarship, engaging writing, interesting storytelling, and depending upon your point of view, rich in insight. So I think it really is quite an impressive accomplishment, And I must say, in terms of the considerations for a true academic, as I am, it's a different medium for communicating, a very different kind of medium for communicating your work than the outlets that I typically use. And so the work that he refers to, focused on summer learning and differences in summer learning along social lines, that work is very well regarded in the professional community and professional research community and among sociologists interested in education. It's very well known, it's very well regarded, but it's available only to a limited few, those of us who read the professional journals and the technical literature. Malcolm Gladwell picks up on this theme and shares it with the wider world. It really is a terrific opportunity to get the word out in a way that more traditional academics just simply cannot do. So I've never met Gladwell. He was on campus a couple years ago, and unfortunately my schedule didn't allow, I wasn't able to attend the session. So I never met him. We never talked about our work. I must say, I was astounded when looking through Outliers and I saw, 5 or 6 pages devoted to it. I thought, this is pretty cool. A guy like Gladwell was, or the people who do the deep background reading for him, came upon this literature and saw its relevance, and here it is. Now, ordinary people are going to be able to share it with just normal, everyday people, and it'll have a much broader impact than what I'd be able to do through the outlets, the publication outlets that are routinely available to me. In fact, it's an interesting coincidence that right around the time that that this book hit the streets and was getting all the massive attention that it did, my wife and I were in the process of refinancing our home, and the mortgage broker that we're working with said, I think I saw your name recently, and weren't you in Outliers? And I thought, well, this is something. This is I've achieved some modest celebrity standing. But what's more important isn't that he connected my name to the Gladwell book, was that he had read about these issues, and I never would have been able to have introduced him to this topic. And so Gladwell, for a person such as myself, Gladwell is a very useful vehicle of communication.
I have to believe that for academics, there's probably a tinge of envy in the fact that you've been working, you in the broader sense, have been working in this area and trying to get people to understand sociology, and particularly in your case, how it involves education. And then somebody can come up with a bestseller like that and reach this broader audience. But on the other hand, I'd also have to believe that for an academic that truly believes it's important for the greater public to understand these theories, Gladwell is a wonderful bridge from those people in the academic world to the broader society, and gives them an easily digestible understanding of some of the issues that you've worked on for so long.
No, you put it very well. In fact, there's very little envy, at least I can't speak for others whose work appears in the book. But I'm actually quite content with my little professional niche and the way that I do my research and the presentations that I make to professional audiences and the publication outlets I have. So I don't aspire to more. I think I have a very realistic sense of what my strengths are and what my limitations are. But having said that, I also firmly believe that, and this isn't just the work that I do, but the work that many of us do, really is of relevance to, has practical relevance to issues that challenge us in helping make the world a better place and helping people that need our help. And to have someone who steps forward to serve as, in a sense, as an intermediary you know, who can speak to a wider audience and a different audience than I, is terrific. So I'm grateful, not envious. I would that there were more Malcolm Gladwells of the world who could spread the good word. But there is a balance to be struck. Actually, before we started the interview, we were talking off mic about pop sociology. And so they're spreading the word in a responsible way, in a useful way. And there's then, on the other hand, they're spreading the word in a way that kind of trivializes the issues or gets far removed from any reasonable base of evidence. So it's just kind of talking and talking without much substance behind it. And that's it. So public scholarship, if you will, comes in many, many guises, and some are more useful than others. I actually think Gladwell is quite responsible in his use of evidence. Not everyone is, and so we do have to be cautious and careful.
Why don't we turn to the book and start looking at some passages that you in particular felt made important points and were representative of Gladwell's writing and some of the things we were just discussing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, the book is rich with possibilities. One that caught my eye, and it does speak to Gladwell's talent in kind of capturing an idea, involves his relating some comments made by Jeb Bush, former President Bush's brother, as we know, and a politician in his own right. So Gladwell, on page 18, quotes Jeb Bush, and when he was asked about whether it was advantageous or disadvantageous to have the family lineage that he does, and he says, "I think overall it's a disadvantage," Jeb Bush once said, of what it meant for his business career that he was the son of an American president and the brother of an American president and the grandson of a wealthy Wall Street banker and U.S. senator. When he ran for governor, he repeatedly referred to himself as, quote, a self-made man. And as a measure of how deeply we associate success with the efforts of individuals, that few batted an eye at that description. And I think, assuming that the quote is accurate, that really should set us all to thinking about what it means, this imagery of the self-made man and the rags to riches.
Horatio
Alger story. There is a conceit that we are makers of our own futures, and certainly one of the points that Gladwell was trying to impress upon all of us is that yes, we may work hard, and yes, we may have exceptional talent, but all of us find our way through life through fortuitous events and through experiences that either help move us ahead or hold us back. So we don't exist in isolation. We're part of a wider community and a wider network, and we do rise or fall on the shoulders of others as well as our own efforts. And I think we all know that, but it's easy to let that slip by when we start thinking not just about our own accomplishments and what we've done, but also the situation of others. Yes, we can credit the self-made man, but the flip side of that is to hold those who are less fortunate, less successful, also personally responsible for their circumstances. So I think it's almost an iconic image, if you will, that someone of Jeb Bush's background can lay claim to being a self-made man. There's a sense in which the absurdity helps make the point.
How about some more passages?
Okay, let me...
While you're looking, or you think about that Jeb Bush story, and you wonder, in this day and age with the press often looking for anything they can to discredit politicians, why he wasn't challenged more often on that statement.
Well, you can pose that question more broadly when you think of all the things that are passed through by the media without unquestioningly. So, well, here's a, I guess there's probably a theme here in the ones that catch my eye. So let me share with you another one. This is on page 32, and he says, "Do you see the consequences of the way we have chosen to think about success? Because we so profoundly personalize success, the self-made man, we miss opportunities to lift others onto the top rung. We make rules that frustrate achievement. We prematurely write off people as failures. We are too much in awe of those who succeed, and too dismissive of those who fail. And most of all, we become too passive. We look just how large a role we all play, and by we, he has that in quotes, I mean society, in determining who makes it and who doesn't." So it's a continuation of that theme that we don't exist in isolation from the circumstances that surround us. We don't rise exclusively through our own efforts, and neither do we fall exclusively through our own failings.
I think what's interesting about both of those passages is I often see public's reaction to people and their success as either being the person being totally self-made, or the opposite is that the global village or the local village is the sole determinant of someone's success. And Gladwell is essentially saying throughout the book that it's not one or the other, it's both in the way they interact, as well as some of the innate ability of the person to take advantage.
That's exactly right. I mean, we don't want to go to either extreme. I mean, he does have quite prominently in the book this 10,000 hour principle, that in order to really rise to the top in virtually any field of endeavor, you have to work very hard. It doesn't come easy, and no one hands it to you typically. And the 10,000 hours captures that. It's 10,000 hours of practice if you're going to become a world-class hockey player, or 10,000 hours spent in the lab to elevate your work to the next level so that you can make the next great discovery. So to recognize that we all rely on those around us and the circumstances that we find ourselves in to move ahead or to fall back is not to say that personal effort and initiative and competence are not important, critical elements of the formula, but it's those competencies and even the dedication and hard work do not in and of itself explain how the exceptional folks rise to the top, or the other side of the coin, the unfortunate folks kind of slip behind and fall farther and farther behind.
I remember, brings to mind a discussion I once had with a close friend who was looking at people in the sales profession. And he said, you can have two people that are equally good at selling but come from different backgrounds, have different levels of polish. And one could be, having a decent living selling automobiles, and someone else could be working on Wall Street selling high-priced securities, and their incomes and lifestyle would be vastly different. Yet the skill level could be the same, and it's just some of the circumstances of their upbringing and that's determined which slot they fell into. And that's not different than some of what Gladwell, I think, is saying.
No, it's absolutely not different. We can all tell stories, about the good fortune or the misfortune. The good fortune of being at the right time in the right place, that opportunity presents itself. When that happens, it could also be the misfortune of finding yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time. There are things in our lives that are beyond our control. Chance occurrences, just circumstance. Gladwell is very clever in identifying conditions that we might not think of ourselves, the cohort born during the depths of the Depression and then coming out of the Depression, the baby being born during the period of the baby boom or the baby bust. The broad demographics play a role in determining whether there's a glut of competition or a scarcity of competition when you're trying to make it in any particular professional line of work. So there are these large externalities involving broad societal conditions, and then there are things that happen up close and personal, very close to home, in our family conditions, circumstances, and our network of intimates that can either help or hinder. And we can be nimble and agile and try to find our way to the niche that's going to be the springboard to success. And some people can maneuver more successfully than others. But at some point, you look around and say, yeah, you know, the conditions either threw up interference or were facilitative. And it's never altogether under our personal control. There are things beyond our control that play a large role in how our lives unfold. It's not simply a matter of just kind of reading from a preordained script where you can anticipate every move.
When Gladwell turned to a discussion of the public education system, public school system in this country, he turned to your work. And one of the quotes was that you suggested that the way in which education is discussed in the United States is backwards. Can we discuss some of those passages and your contribution to the book?
No, you'll have to twist my arm. one of the excerpts from the book that I had picked out here, because it does tie in with the work of mine that he uses. He says that for the poorest students, America doesn't have a school problem; it has a summer vacation problem. He goes on to say, in effect, that the schools aren't broke, but there are conditions outside the school that are fundamentally important to children's academic success or failure that we often lose sight of when we focus our policy lens on school improvements and school correctives for helping move children along, and in particular as a vehicle for helping lift up disadvantaged children from low-income families. So the popular mantra is, if you to get ahead in life, you really need to work hard, play by the rules, and if you perform well in school, then a world of opportunity awaits you. Doing well in school is the vehicle for moving up in the world and for extricating yourself from poverty. And of course, there are elements of truth to that, but schools don't exist in isolation. Schools are part of the kind of larger fabric of society. And while children are going to school, they're also going to family. You know, so families are continuing influence in children's lives and their personal development and their academic development. And what our work shows is that and it's based in Baltimore here. It's actually it's a study that was launched way back in the early 80s, 1982, when a colleague in the sociology department, Doris Entwistle, launched a research study that we called the Beginning School Study, because its intent was to focus intensively on the beginning school transition, that is, the experience of first grade as children are just acclimating to the life in school, children being obliged to negotiate the transition from being home child to school child, is one of the ways to put it. So it's a transformative time in children's lives. And how they weather that transition has implications that echo well into the future in terms of how well they're likely to succeed in school in later years, and then how school serves as a bridge to later opportunities beyond school, in adulthood. So in the Beginning School Study research program, we track the educational experience and family conditions of a large group of youngsters attending Baltimore City Public Schools, about 800 in total. And we talked to them and their parents and their teachers, and we had access to school records, so we compiled a rather substantial kind of database on the experiences of these youngsters at the earliest stages of their schooling. And then we continued to monitor the life progress for years after, extending, in fact, all the way up to almost age 30. We talked to them. These were youngsters who were first graders in 1982, and we talked to 80% of the original group as young adults at age 28, 29 in 2006. But the story about summer learning and winter learning traces back to the early elementary years. What we were able to do, looking at nationally normed standardized achievement tests, so we're talking about kind of nuts and bolts of learning, the kind of learning that shows up on achievement tests. We looked at how improvement in test scores tracked across the elementary school years, starting at the very beginning of first grade, extending through the end of fifth grade or the end of elementary school, and the way the Baltimore school system is constructed. And because of the farsightedness of the folks at the Baltimore City Public School System at the time, and I say farsightedness because this was very useful as a research as research leverage for the kinds of questions we were interested in. They were doing twice annual testing. The Baltimore City Public School System at the time was doing twice annual testing, fall at the beginning of the school year, and again in the spring at the end of the school year. So we had compiled a database that included fall and spring achievement testing for first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade, same children over time. It's a panel study. And with that information on, having that information available to us, allowed us to plot their achievement gains for this group of 800 or so youngsters, to plot their achievement gains over the school year, which is progress they registered from fall to spring, beginning of the school year to the end of the school year. And that's a pretty standard thing to do in the literature. You know, how are children advancing while they're in school? But what's not so standard, and what we were able to do because we had the twice annual testing, is to also calculate their achievement gains over the summer months, summer learning, as opposed to school year learning. This is in the early elementary grades, first grade through fifth. And the way you calculate summer gains is to look at where the children's scores were at the end of a given academic year, and then where their scores are at the beginning of the next one, so the end of first grade to the beginning of second grade. And that interval brackets the summer. And so with the twice annual testing, which is really quite uncommon, you can compare school year learning to summer learning. That's a long-winded setup to what turns out to be a straightforward, but in fact quite compelling story. When you look at achievement growth in that way, what you find is that the achievement gap across social lines, that is the difference in the average achievement level of children from low-income households versus children from higher-income households, the achievement gap across social lines that's obvious in the early elementary grades, substantially originates over the summer months. And it's during the summer months that children from middle-class households, professional families, college-educated parents, those children are continuing to build up their academic skills over the summer months, the kinds of skills that show up on paper and pencil achievement tests, because their parents, they're living in a resource-rich environment, if you will. Their parents, being professional and college-educated, they're fluent verbally. Parents model an interest in reading because there are books in the house and there are newspapers, magazines. Parents will often, they typically read to their children, they'll rehearse reading with their children, they'll work on number facts with their children. These children will also have enriching experiences over the summer months. They'll go to museums, they'll go to summer camp, they'll take gym lessons, they'll work on learning how to play the piano, they'll go on overnight trips. They'll have expansive experiences during the summer months. Children from lower income families, the poor and near poor, they don't have that kind of environment, either within the house or beyond the house, in terms of excursions out to out to the museums and going on family vacations. Their achievement scores don't improve over the summer months. We call it summer slide or summer setback. Basically, they're treading water. These youngsters are performing at the beginning of the full school year about at the same level that they were performing at the end of the previous one. So basically, it's a flat profile. So what you find is that the achievement gap, the children from more advantaged households, they're continuing to build up their skills, the kinds of skills that pay off in school, over the summer months, whereas lower income children are not. And so the in our project here in Baltimore, what we find is that essentially the entire increase in the achievement gap from first grade through fifth grade traces to differential out-of-school learning during the summer months, which is really quite extraordinary.
Probably not unexpected, though.
Well, it depends on what your expectations are, actually. I think it's been this work, and it's not exclusive to our project. The same pattern now has been documented in other studies, including studies done at the national level. But what it does is it directs your attention to the fundamental importance of enriching experiences outside of school for developing school-based competencies, the kinds of skills that pay off in terms of being able to perform at a high level academically. So when Gladwell says we don't have a school problem, we have a summer problem, what he's pointing out is that low-income and disadvantaged children, not all, but in general, are denied the kinds of enriching opportunity, the kinds of learning experiences and enriching opportunities and enriching experiences that middle-class children have more or less routinely through the way their families work, the experiences of family life.
Kind of the flip side of that, I'm reminded of a discussion I heard a number of years ago between two young teachers who had gotten their education degrees together. One went to work in an inner city school, and the other went to work in an independent school. And they were talking in the late fall after back to school season. And the one in the inner city said on back to school night, there were hardly any parents who showed up. And the one in the independent school said, every parent showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And that would seem to be to correlate to your concept of those students not getting adequate support, not only in the summertime, but probably at home in general.
Well, I think that's exactly correct. It's just one element of a very large, set of issues that come together to have similar implications, that parents who are knowledgeable about what it takes to be successful in school and are energetic in working with their children to build a strong foundation, those parents are really making a difference in their children's lives that will pay off over the long haul. So yes, I mean, here at Hopkins we have an education research and development center, one of the best in the world, and one of the research scientists at the center, Joyce Epstein, has been working for a decade plus on strategies for strengthening what she calls homeschool partnerships. As schools reach out, parents will reach in. Strategies to try to remediate precisely the difficulty that you've identified, that many parents just aren't aware of what they can do to help move their children ahead. And when they are aware, they might not have the tools to do so. So they need help. And schools can play a very constructive role in reaching out to provide that help. But it's challenging in a whole host of ways. You can go through a checklist of what's available to your typical child of a professional family that isn't available to the typical child of a low-income family poverty level or near poverty level. And it's an impressive checklist. Computers in the home, access to the web, lots of reading materials, parents who read and themselves are highly literate and verbally fluent, these trips and enriching experiences. It goes on and on and on. But the differences in family life are deeper than that, and you can't capture those differences adequately through a checklist approach. There are just deeply embedded differences in family life that envelop children's as they grow up, and have cumulative consequences. I'm reminded as I talk about it, there's a remarkable book by two child development psychologists who videotaped family life on site, that is in the household, on a monthly basis for the first 3 years of children's lives. And these children were brought into the study at birth, and then on a monthly basis through 3 years, the researchers went in and observed household, the way families conducted themselves, videotaping, and then doing a content analysis of what they observed, what they recorded. And they were looking at three types of families, professional families, working class families, and welfare level families. And they were particularly interested in the use of language in the home. And what they found were some truly extraordinary differences across social lines. And one of their findings probably captures that more vividly than anything else I can think of. And what they found was that the total number of words used spontaneously in day-to-day kind of interaction within the household, the total number of words used by three-year-old children in middle-class families exceeded the total number of different words, kind of unique words, so a variety of language. Total number of unique words used by three-year-old children in middle-class households exceeded those used by parents in welfare-level households. So you're talking about fundamentally different kind of household environments in terms of the richness and use of language. And that's over a three-year period in infancy, but it continues. So we're talking about differences in family life that are profoundly important. And these differences obviously play out outside school. So Gladwell's point, and he uses our research to make the point, is that the family is the first educator, and much of the focus on education policy and school reform as the way to lift children up is misplaced, in the sense that schools typically play a secondary role in children's lives, whereas families play a primary role. And it's challenging, maybe too challenging, to think that the burdens that children carry with them into school from outside school can be fully remediated through school-based interventions. So we don't have a school problem, we have a summer problem. That's the sense of it. But there's a deep foundation to it that needs to that helps make that meaningful.
If you were organizing a group of alumni in a book club discussion, I'd like you to throw out two or three key issues, just briefly, that you think that they would love to discuss.
Well, sure. Actually, I was in advance. You asked me to come to think through another discussion topics, and certainly outliers is rich with possibilities. Well, let me try a few and see if this if the listeners will rise to the occasion and find these to be kind of intriguing topics to take on. So one involves Gladwell's account of his own family lineage that he takes up in the epilogue. And so it's an interesting exercise where he reflects back on his own upbringing and family circumstances as filtered through the interpretive logic of outliers. And I think it might be interesting for those of us, those who are listening in and engaged in a discussion group to revisit their own experiences growing up through the lens and interpretive logic of outliers. So how circumstances and family conditions shaped our own personal journeys, and what has been the balance between merit, as success is achieved through just raw talent and hard work, and fortuitous opportunity. Yeah. A bit of introspection here to see if we can kind of do our own Gladwell-esque interpretive accounting of our own as our lives, of our own lives as they played forward.
I think that would be something fascinating for a group to share their own stories and interpreting their own success based on some of the theories that Gladwell throws out.
Okay, well, let's see what comes in when we try that. One of the things that's that really I thought was intriguing about how Gladwell chose to advance his agenda, offering his interpretive account, is that he stopped short of policy advocacy, this quote, sort of in your face, let's fix the problem and here's how we do it. But surely there are policy implications that would follow from his account of success, and I'm wondering what some of those might be. So for example, if you except what Gladwell has to say about the conditions that make for success and the conditions, the other side of the coin, the conditions that hold many, many back. Are there implications of that for public policy, such as the appropriateness of an inheritance tax? Do we keep it all for ourselves? Ought that to be an entitlement? If we didn't get it all on our own, is it really ours? Is there a public claim on some portion of what we managed to accumulate over the years? Another might be how we fund our public schools. Property taxes are at the local level are the main revenue stream for public education. But property taxes differ here in the state of Maryland. There are tremendous differences between the property tax rate across counties. Baltimore City's is much higher than any of the surrounding counties, as we know. Baltimore County's wealthier than Baltimore City on a per capita basis nowadays. But should children be the beneficiaries of their good fortune of where they happen to be born, in the city or in the county? Children have no control over that. But the happenstance of birth has profound implications for the quality of the education and the funding of their school systems by virtue of our tax policies. So, local property taxes, is that the right way to fund public education when it means that some children are going to have access to much more generously funded schools and others will have to make do with less generous funding? Children are caught up in that. The ones that have the advantages didn't themselves do anything to deserve those advantages. The ones that are disadvantaged, children I'm saying, didn't do anything themselves to deserve their disadvantage, and yet our system rewards some more generously than others, or supports some more generously than others. And there are other public policy issues that could equally as well be kind of thought through in terms of what Gladwell has to say about the paths to success.
To wrap up, are there any fundamental questions that you would like the listeners, the readers, to ask themselves or each other as they go through the book, and some things that you'd like them to keep in the back of their mind as they read Gladwell?
Well, you know, one thing that I think is well worth pondering is the meritocratic imagery that Gladwell directs our attention to. The formula for success is hard work applied to the talents that you have is the way to is the route to personal advancement. So if we were willing to work hard and we use our abilities to the fullest, things will work out just fine. And this meritocratic imagery is, I don't want to say peculiarly American, because I don't want to seem too U.S.-centric here. But it's this meritocratic imagery that Gladwell sketches really is thought to be almost fundamental to the American character. And he's obliging us to step back and say, is it really that simple? And I think if you ask that question, and as you go through the book, is it really that simple? What he's showing are exceptions to the simple rule. Mm-hmm. And there are many. And there are
the discussion, the comparison of Langan to Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. is one that comes to mind for me.
But in point of fact, I think you could look at almost every one of those many stories that Gladwell weaves and use it as a vehicle for addressing that question. Is it really that simple? Do hard work and apply to the innate talents you have really win the day? Is that what makes the difference?
Thank you very much, Dr. Alexander, for a fascinating discussion. I'd like to remind our listeners that Dr. Alexander will be posting several questions on the website for online discussion during the months of May and June. We look forward to your participation and look forward to you coming back to the online book club when we restart in the fall. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.